Audible.com is the leading provider in spoken word entertainment, including books, magazines, newspapers, and podcasts. They have over 35,000 books to choose from, including a large selection of conservative titles. Log on to audible.com/townhall to get a free audiobook download when you sign up today. Again, that's audible.com/townhall for your free audiobook.
And hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dennis Prager Show, where we try to understand life. And that's a perfect intro to my guest. I welcome you, and I welcome Lee Harris. Lee Harris has become one of my favorite thinkers in our time. He's the author of, we've had him on that, Civilization and Its Enemies. Pretty heavy titles, but they are well-read, well-written books. Well-read, I hope. Well-written, I know. And Lee Harris has just written The Suicide of Reason, Radical Islam's Threat to the West. There are a number of books on this. I don't know of any that are better. He has thought through whether or not we in the Western world are capable of dealing with the fanaticism that has taken over parts of the Islamic world. Lee Harris, welcome back to the Dennis Prager Show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. First of all, a question, which I don't suspect many of your interviewers have asked you, and that is, who is Andy Fuson?
He is my partner of 20 years.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. Was that a fair question?
Certainly it was. I'm very proud of him and of our relationship.
Wonderful. Well, it's dedicated to him, and I'm always curious. There was one author I had who dedicated his book to his mother-in-law. That was a first, I have to say. I had never encountered that.
Yes, well, I think the person who has to live with me when I'm writing a book deserves a lot of credit, because writing a book, especially this last one, was not the easiest thing to do psychologically and emotionally, because the book was very troubling to me to write. I wasn't happy about writing this book or coming to some of the conclusions I came to, because essentially I was not simply questioning this abstract thing called the liberal West. I was questioning myself and my own values that I have been raised with and have held on to throughout my entire life.
Well, give me an example of a value of yours that this book forced you to confront.
Well, tolerance, for example. I have always been, in my own personal life, a very tolerant person. I try to bend over backwards to deal with people, if somebody is a little bit of a bully, I try to, calm that person down. I try to use reason. I'm one of those people who believes that in this immense power of reason to soothe over differences and to get people to give up conflict. And so I had to, in writing this book, recognize the fact that all these things that I treasure in my own life may have really profound limitations in dealing with people who have radically different values than mine. And they may, in fact, leave me, and my society as well, vulnerable to forces that just simply cannot be dealt with by reason, tolerance, and moderation, and those the liberal virtues of the West, in short.
Well, I salute you because, unfortunately, in my view, too many in the West don't understand that what they revere doesn't work in fighting those who want to destroy it.
Exactly, and it's a painful thing to recognize. And I think I hope I wrote this book to help other people confront the pain of recognizing that some of their most treasured values simply may not work in the situation that we find ourselves in today, vis-a-vis radical Islam.
I have said to my audience in writing and on my radio show for now 25 years, the Achilles heel of modern liberalism, and I don't mean this as a political statement, but as a philosophical one.
I understand.
The Achilles heel is the incapacity to recognize and confront genuine evil.
Well, I think you're correct, because basically liberalism depends upon an anthropology that views man as fundamentally decent, kind-hearted, willing to cooperate, willing to compromise. And unfortunately, as I argued in my first book, this is a product of the fact that we have forgotten how man in his normal state is, that we are the exception, we are not the rule, that if you go through the annals of history, you don't have to go very far back, you find, you know, the most horrible bloodshed, massacre after massacre. You find people, despots, rising to power through ruthless means. You find gangs, predatory gangs, seizing what they want from productive, you know, peasants who are trying to, you know, just take care of their own lives. And this is really the court of human history. We are this oasis that is unlike any other period in mankind's past. And our tragedy is we don't recognize that fact. We don't see ourselves as being this historical oasis. And nor do we see the fact that how fragile and how vulnerable our little oasis is.
Yep, that's exactly right. And the civilization is inherently weak because decivilization is the norm.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's so painful. All right, so your book is about this, that the West may not be inherently capable. It may be self-paralyzed in confronting radical Islam.
Yes, and it may be self-paralyzed not because we are horrible people, but because we are in fact so decent. The irony of the book, and the hardest thing for me to deal with psychologically in writing it, was the fact that it may be our virtues that do us in, and not our vices. Our vices are not helping, but it may be our attempt to do good, our attempt to see other people as being fair-minded and decent like ourselves, that make us systematically distort and underestimate what we're having to contend with. And it's for example, one of the issues in writing this book that was very difficult was, and has been difficult in terms of getting it reviewed, and is the fact that I use the word fanaticism to characterize Islam. That is, of course, politically incorrect. But the problem is that from its inception, Islam has been recognized by people until very recently that fanaticism was a core value to it. For us, fanaticism is something that's evil. To be called a fanatic is a bad thing unless you're calling someone a baseball fanatic or something. But to be a fanatic in the liberal world or liberal discourse is to be a villain. But if you come from a society in which fanatical devotion to your group, a fanatical devotion to your tradition is the highest of all values, then it is no insult to be called a fanatic at all. That's what you want to be. So the problem I had in writing the book was getting people to understand that when I say that Islam has been characterized by high degree of fanaticism, this is not a judgmental insult. This is an attempt to really understand the psychology, the psychological glue that has given Islam such formidable power in human history. And I think one of the things that everyone I hope can understand, if they can get one thing from my book, is the fact that Islam has been an enormously successful political, religious institution insofar as it's been able to spread from its source in Saudi Arabia, you know, to the distant parts of the globe. And in all but a few places, it has never been pushed back. And the only times, the exceptions here that prove the rule, the only time when it has been pushed back, like in the Spanish reconquest of Spain, it's been because the people who were working against it were animated by the same degree of fanaticism, a kind of counter-jihad.
I wrote in an article of mine about a couple of years ago, only good religion can counter bad religion. I don't mean all of Islam, but I mean those who have bad religion can only be countered by those with good religion, that the secular world is too self-weakened for exactly the reasons you just said. An equal fervor. You can't be, one cannot have the fervor for tolerance that one has for, let us say, God.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just the way it is.
Let me tell you a story. I was asked a couple of years ago after I wrote Civilization as Enemies it was a book that was chosen by a book discussion group. And the moderator called me up and he said, so let me ask you a personal question. Are you for or against religion? And I was really taken aback by this question, and my answer was something along the lines, well, I'm for those religions that believe in helping the poor. I'm against those religions that believe in sacrificing babies. And this is the kind of mentality we're developing among so many intellectuals today, is that they see religion as a black and white thing. You're either for it or against it.
CNN is having a three-part series on religious fundamentalism, one Judaism, one Christianity, one Islam. As if they are all right now in a morally equivalent state.
Well, yes, that's exactly. One of the first responses I got to something I wrote 5 years ago was an attack basically on the idea that, oh, well, listen, we have our fundamentalist fanatics too, just like they have their fanatics. And my response to that has been this, and I deal with this in my new book, Suicide of Reason, is that, you know, this is a complete confusion here. A fundamentalist in the United States may believe things that a liberal intelligent liberal finds silly, but the fundamentalist in the United States is not going to go burning things down or blowing up biology departments.
Okay? Wouldn't one think that that's an elementary distinction? It's an important book, and we will continue. Lee Harris, The Suicide of Reason, Radical Islam's Threat to the West. We may not be up to the job of fighting. We have weakened ourselves with our theories. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show.
The title of the book is excellent.
The Suicide of Reason, Radical Islam's Threat to the West. It's actually the West's threat to the West, which enables radical Islam to perhaps prevail. The book is by Lee Harris. I'm Dennis Prager. And there are times when I have such agreement with an author when it is almost difficult to enable you the time to speak, because I'm so enthused to have somebody who's as clear as I feel one needs to be. I'd like you to give some examples, if you would, concrete examples of the way in which the West or America self-paralyze by their own thinking.
Well, I think the best case would be the response to 9/11, where essentially our response was, "What did we do wrong?" And I'm not simply attacking the liberals on the left. The neoconservative response was essentially that there's something wrong in the Middle East, that it can be fixed if we eliminate the poverty, give them, you know, free and fair elections, get rid of their tyrants, that everything will be okay. And of course, on the left, there was this idea that we had done something that, you know, somehow deserved a response like this. My argument from the very beginning, when I started thinking about all this, and which I continue in the current book, is that essentially we're not looking at the fact that ruthlessness and terror, fanaticism, these are all strategies for survival that work for those who are willing and able to employ them. They have worked through century after century after century. They will continue to work as long as people can get what they want by pursuing their goals through terror, ruthlessness, and methods like that. So, in other words, we're not dealing with a social pathology. We're dealing with a very powerful instrument by which societies have been able both to defend themselves and to conquer and defeat other societies. And unless we're willing to look at these things, these phenomena like terrorism, in light of the larger scale of human history, then we're not going to see how vulnerable we are, because we're going to think that this is a problem that somehow we can engineer a solution to, instead of it being a challenge for which we do not have any available instruments. I think one of the most harmful parallels that has been developed in response to 9/11 and the whole crisis was the idea that radical Islam is something like Nazism or Soviet communism. And let me explain why I think this is such a terribly misleading parallel. Nazism, Soviet communism were both ideologies that basically went against the grain of the people that accepted them. Nazism was fanatically anti-Christian, anti-Jewish, as we all know. Soviet communism was profoundly, you know, anti-Christian, atheistic. So both religions were imposed on people that fundamentally against the grain of their nature. It was accepted to some extent. But radical Islam is an emanation out of traditional Islam. It is not a repudiation of it all. It is simply a revival of earlier forms of Islam, like the jihad. Jihad has been a defining instrument of Islam from the very beginning. I mean, people would not be speaking Arab all over the northern Africa and the Mediterranean unless there had been these conquests. So jihad is the instrument by which Islam spread. And jihad has always remained a fixed idea in Islam. It will die down at certain periods, and then it will rev up again. And what we're seeing now is a colossal revving up of jihad, and a desire to return to traditional, or what are perceived as traditional Islamic ways. So we're not seeing a artificial religion being grafted onto a society that doesn't really accept it in its roots. We're seeing a revival that's coming from within. And I think the moment you grasp that difference, you can see that we're up against a threat that cannot be eliminated through internal collapse like the Soviet Union was, when it simply got too big of, it was too big of an empire to stay afloat. And it wasn't like Nazism, where it could be defeated simply by, you know, military measures. We're dealing with something that is much longer term, that will be around a great deal longer, and which is a much more insidious threat to us, even though they don't have the, you know, the arms and nuclear weapons or things like that.
So what would you answer, since to the question posed to me since 9/11 itself, constantly by callers, Dennis, is Islam a violent religion? What would you answer if you had my microphone?
Islam, yeah, let me just preface this by saying that I think another essential thing to understand about Islam, because I'm often asked, well, you know, haven't Christians been fanatics? And yes, of course they've been. But there's an elementary distinction between the origin of Christianity and the origin of Islam, which is, I think, extremely important to stress, is that the teachings of Jesus came about under the Roman Empire. He wasn't trying to create a new political order. He was expecting the end of the world. He was preaching an otherworldly ethos. Okay? Islam began as this development of a political community that was inspired by a revelation. That is, Muhammad had to create and defend a community, to create a political organization. So therefore, violence was a necessary part of its survival. Christianity could afford to say, we will not be violent, because they were an otherworldly religion. But Muhammad was trying to create a community that would be lasting, that would continue, you know, century after century. And therefore, it had to involve itself with things like warfare. So from its very essence, I'm not saying that it set out to be violent. It had to be violent. And the great conquest could not have taken place, obviously, unless it had been brought about by men who were trained for violence and who were prepared for ruthlessness. So the very fundamental germs out of which the two religions come are radically different. And so, yes, Islam is essentially a religion that was born with violence, not necessarily out of violence, and it spread through violence. Now, does that mean all Muslims are violent? No, it doesn't mean that at all. Does that mean that Islam cannot in the future one day reject that past? Well, that could happen too. But right now, we're not seeing a rejection of the violent tradition of jihad. We're seeing an embrace of it. We're seeing the spread of that idea through the Islamic world, and a revitalization of the old pugnacious, we're going to spread our faith point of view.
When I have raised these issues, and it very, very well spoken, when I have raised them, the answer from Muslim defenders, or even non-Muslim defenders like Karen Armstrong, has been, well, then why didn't we see these terrorists for all of Muslim history? It's a relatively newer phenomenon. How would you answer that?
Well, it isn't a relatively new phenomenon at all. And I admire Karen Armstrong, but, you know...
You do?
I admire a lot of people that I don't agree with. I'll put it that way. I find it very easy to admire other people, even people, especially sometimes people I don't agree with. But let me just say that this is that simply isn't the case. Of course, they didn't use modern terrorism, because terrorism, in that sense, is a modern phenomenon that goes back to the 19th century.
All right, let me hear the rest of the answer in a moment. I want everybody to know again the name of this important book, The Suicide of Reason, Radical Islam's Threat to the West. Lee Harris is the author. I'm Dennis Prager. We continue. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show. It's a troubling book, well-written, The Suicide of Reason, Radical Islam's Threat to the West. But the point, of course, is the suicide of reason. The people who in effect, hold reason as the highest value in which to come to decisions are fighting people for whom reason is irrelevant, and they are largely incapacitated in their ability to fight such people. And I agree wholeheartedly, and I have asked you the question after your answer about Islam, where you say it was born in violence, and I asked why then, or how do you answer defenders of Islam, whether they are Muslim or non-Muslim, who say, well, wait a minute, then why wasn't there all this terror before the recent past? And you were answering.
Well, we must distinguish between modern terrorism, like blowing up bombs and innocent crowds of people, from terror, as it's been employed throughout history by predatory groups. For example, when the Arab conquerors, they didn't begin by conquering the Sassanian Empire or the Byzantine Empire. They began kind of just making predatory raids, just plundering, going into it. And of course, when you rob people, there's always an amount of terror that's involved there, you know. Finally, they realized, well, instead of these people are so soft and weak, that instead of simply going every now and then and robbing them, we can just knock off the people who are running the pyramid and take their place and start collecting the tribute from the peasants, which is what they did. Now, here again, this was a change of that was brought about through violence. There's no other way you can get people to relinquish control of a very well-paying empire unless it's through violence. So the expansion of Islam, unlike the expansion of Judaism or Christianity, was carried out through violence. And this is just, you know, to ignore this fact is to simply ignore Islamic history. Now, my point is that if you really want to understand Islam, you have to understand that this is not considered a bad thing if you are a true traditional Muslim. That there's an understanding that God meant everyone to be Muslim. So in a sense, it's like they're liberating mankind so that they can all be Muslims, but they have to do it sometimes by force. And this is just part of the Islamic traditions. Now, if modern Muslims want to say, well, this is a part we'd rather forget about and we will move on, I would be all for it. But that's not what I'm seeing happening in the world, nor is, I think you agree with me. We're seeing a revival of jihad. We're seeing this being thrown up once again as an ideal to be followed.
All right, so what has changed then with the 1960s, 1970s? Somebody came up with the idea of suicide terror? What changed?
Well, terrorism was used, of course, during the Algerian War of Independence with great effect. But terrorism, you know, is back to the 19th century. Luigi Orsini tried to blow up Louis Napoleon at the French Opera House and ended up killing about 12 innocent people.
But the target was the leader. The target wasn't the people.
That's right.
That's very important.
You're correct on that.
Yeah, so 19th century terror, it was against the Tsar. It was against the whomever.
Yes.
In fact, the guys who killed Archduke Ferdinand were unbelievably sad that they had killed his wife as well.
Right. During the Algerian War of Independence, however, terrorism was used against civilians, but not in the sense that we want to kill as many civilians as we can.
Right. So what has happened?
Well, what happened, I think, this is a personal interpretation. I think the West decided to start making apologies and excuses for acts of terrorism done by the Palestinians. I think that there was a whole lobby that developed that basically argued, well, they don't have jet airplanes, therefore what choice do they have except by blowing people up in a pizzeria?
The poor man's Apache.
Exactly. And I think that we were in making that apologetic stance towards them, I think we were crippling and injuring them beyond anything that if we had intended evil, we could have done. Because what happened is that terror became the system by which Palestinians virtually do everything. I mean, the whole idea of a Palestinian state will never be possible because terror has become the choice, the instrument they used to achieve political goals. They use it against Israel and they use it against each other just as easily. Terrorism in that sense is like this horrible disease, the epidemic that once it's, you know.
Yeah, all right, hold on there. Lee Harris, my guest, The Suicide of Reason, your chance now, 1-8-PRAGER-776. Do we have the ability to fight people who want to destroy us? 1-8-PRAGER-776, that's Lee Harris's fundamental question. In this powerful book, The Suicide of Reason, that reason alone, if you think that alone can prevail against non-rational evil, then you are mistaken. I will take your calls now, but I want to ask you, if I may, to get to Lee Harris for a moment. You said it was painful to write this, and my suspicion is that it was painful because you yourself have the liberal, rational beliefs.
Yes.
And
I joke about being a knee-jerk liberal. I mean, it's like what Spiro Agnew used to say. I am one. And I had to analyze my knee-jerks, kind of.
That's right. That's exactly right. I did that very early in life. I was a knee-jerk liberal, too. And I was trained that way, and you know, Ivy League graduate school and all that stuff. And then I realized during the Cold War, these people didn't understand evil. It was evil that made me reject the modern liberal view of the world, because I didn't think it had the capacity to confront it. I would come back from the Soviet Union, and I would talk to Americans, and people would stand up. And I don't mean radical lefties. I mean, you know, people. And they would say, oh, come on, sir. You know, mothers are the same everywhere. Every mother loves her child, whether she's a communist or a fascist or a Democrat or Republican. Everybody's the same underneath. And I would say, well, underneath isn't the issue.
Exactly. But you understand that attitude that you found in the people you talk to is a signature of American good nature. It is, we really genuinely want to believe other people are nice and decent. And this is one of the heartbreaking things, is that, you know, I would hate to see Americans become a people who are distrustful and who don't have, who no longer trust in other people's decency. And yet it's something that we may be forced into, you know, by circumstances way beyond our control. And that to me is what made the book such an emotionally enriching thing for me to write.
Do you feel at all, given your life and given your knee-jerk tendencies, that you're somewhat in nowhere? Or do you feel you have ideological allies?
No, I don't feel like I do. And at the end of my book, I basically argue for two political paradigms, one liberal, one conservative. In other words, I'm not posing myself as a liberal or conservative. What I'm trying to do simply is I'm trying to be like a doctor looking at a patient and trying to be as clinical and dispassionate as I can be about whether this patient will live or not. And I have to put aside my own desires to see, you know, to see a liberal, tolerant, reasonable world flourished all over the place. So it's been, I'm trying to simply pose the problem. I'm not trying to really say the solution is here or there. I'm trying to say that if there's going to be a solution that works, it must be on the understanding that we have a realistic view of what the position we're in and what we're up against. Unless we have a realistic diagnosis of our condition, then any solution becomes wildly wrong.
Have you been called Islamophobic?
I'm not sure. I've been called all sorts of things, but I'm sure I've been called that. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm sure I've been called that. And one of the odd things about that term is that you can fear something you admire. That is, Hitler, for example, admired Stalin a great deal. Even when Stalin was running his armies into Germany, he said he was the greatest leader of his time. Yet he certainly feared Stalin. But you can look at another culture. I can look at Islam and see why people who are Muslims are, you know, feel such devotion to their tradition. And I sometimes wish we could feel the same kind of devotion to our traditions here. And I could admire many aspects of their culture, but at the same time, I have to kind of fear it as a liberal. Or as a gay man, I have to fear it. Because, I mean, in the United States, you have fundamentalists who don't want gay marriage. That's as far as they go. A moderate in Islam wants to see homosexuals killed in the worst way possible. That's a real difference. And unless people face up to that kind of existential difference, then, you know, any attempt to find a solution, I think, is in vain.
Here is the irony, if I may be personal, since you were personal.
Sure,
And I, you know, after after you had mentioned about who was dedicated to, I didn't want to play on it, but I'm glad you mentioned that. Here, I want to present to you your fascinating thing about Lee Harris's life. I, Dennis Prager, am religious, and I believe that marriage should be male-female. I suspect that you believe that we should have same-sex marriage.
No, I don't.
Oh, you don't. Okay. Well,
actually, I read an essay about that was that got me called homophobic.
No kidding. How fascinating. Well, then it obviates what I was about to say, but I'll say it anyway.
Okay, go ahead.
Because it reminds me of another Harris that I had on my show, whom, of course, I disagreed with a great deal, Sam Harris, the atheist.
Right.
And to his credit, he said, you know, there really is a terrible threat today from within the Islamic world. And I said, it's very interesting you should say that, Sam Harris, because the only people in general saying that are conservatives, and the ones saying it most passionately are religious conservatives, the people you most differ with. And I feel like saying to a gay who is in the position of understanding the threat to the West coming from within the Islamic world, your best friends are the people who don't want same-sex marriage.
Oh, I agree with you, absolutely. And let me clarify a little bit about my past. I was raised a Southern Baptist. I know people like that who I admire deeply and profoundly. And someone like Sam Harris, I find his ideas a little bit on the, well, shallow side. And I think that, once again, he's one of those people who needs to go back and look at history and ask himself, how did the liberal West come into existence?
Right. That's right.
I think that's a
yes.
Core he should set himself.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, we'll return with Lee Harris. Final segment. I got to get to some of your calls. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show. It is a real pleasure to talk to this man, Lee Harris. And his book, The Suicide of Reason. Where is your essay, by the way, that you mentioned? It's not apropos of the book. But
it was the Future Tradition in Policy Review. It was published about 2 years ago.
In Policy Review?
Yeah, and basically in it I argue something, what you're arguing, that essentially we have to recognize that what I call ethical fundamentalism, that is, there are certain values that really cannot be questioned in the society. We have to kind of accept them. They're the foundation by which our moral values are upheld. And I think that it's very dangerous when intellectuals begin picking at those foundations, because the foundations themselves are not, they are the thing that create reason. They cannot be justified by reason, but they are the foundation by which reason emerges into the world. And one of the things that I thought was when the whole gay marriage issue came up is that I was rather taken aback by how few non-religious conservatives defended, you know, traditional marriage. And my position was that, you know, this is traditional marriage is what marriage is. If gay people, you know, want to get together and live together like the way my partner and I do, that's fine. We're accepted by the wider community, and that's all I ask for. I think that it's an amazing feat of tolerance that has been shown to us by the general community. And I think, you know, pushing for more was politically not well advised, and I think it also went against the grain of people's idea of what is fundamentally right and wrong, and I think it's dangerous to do that in our society.
You're a rare man. Let me quickly summarize some questions here. Jim in L.A. says, did invading Iraq support repressive regimes and supporting did invading Iraq and supporting repressive regimes in the Middle East cause more terrorism?
Did it cause more terrorism?
Yeah. In other words, how much are we at all responsible for the increase in terror? Or is it all from within?
Well, I think the actions that we took, as I say in my book, I feel that we were sucked into the idea of a quick fix in Iraq that was simply not tenable. And I think this in my book I talk about we exist in a carpe diem ethos, which is where we want everything right now. And I think that politics, that world, that mindset spilled over into our policy in Iraq, where we really thought we could go in, take out Saddam Hussein and everything, just tell them to write a constitution, have elections.
What you're saying is a lot of conservatives, like a lot of liberals, have a naive view of human nature.
I agree with you.
You're okay, Lee Harris, and the book is wonderful. I hope we meet one day. The book is The Suicide of Reason, Radical Islam's Threat to the West. Keep writing. Thank you so much.
Well, I enjoyed it so much. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And we continue on The Dennis Prager Show.